Hello, welcome to the 21cc podcast, brought to you by the Chartered Institute of Building, and it's their birthday! The CIOB is 190 this year! Okay, that's enough. That's right! 1834 it all kicked off, before artificial intelligence, before the internet, before computers, television, radio, airplanes, cars, light bulbs, Marmite, plastic, and Canada, there was the CIOB! I'm Rod Sweet, editor of Global Construction Review, and this episode is a special one. I mean, they're all special, but this is a bit more special. We have wonderful guests today. We're going to talk to Michael Brown, educator, industry diplomat, and former CIOB deputy chief executive, about what construction and the Institute were like before email. And because the CIOB's royal charter obliges it to promote the science and practice of building for the public benefit, Justin Stanton is here to ask industry leaders how data can facilitate higher performance construction. But to kick things off, we're going to look ahead in a thrilling conversation with three young CIOB people from around the world, members of the Institute's Tomorrow's Leaders Network, about the one thing they'd like to change about the industry and how the CIOB can help with that. I was privileged to speak to Tadiwa Temu, 23, a junior project manager building a retirement complex in Cape Town, South Africa, and engineer Ziad Abdin, 25, a contracts engineer working on various projects in Dubai, and Dr. Hamza Momade, 31, a construction project manager with Roney Group in Toronto and a professor of construction management at Ontario's Durham College. It was so great to talk to them. Let's hear from Tadiwa first on what she'd like to see changed.
So I joked and said one of them would be the toilets on site. But on a more serious note, I think one thing that I would want us to change is sustainability. Sustainability is usually seen as just the environment, but how sustainable is it when we have a construction industry which is just mainly male dominated and also doesn't take into effect mental health? How can we truly talk about sustainability when we forget that part of the resources involved is labor? It's not just the bricks and the mortar. Overlooking labor in that conversation really takes away from how sustainable construction industry can be when we have high suicide rates, gender disparity, and low ratings and environmental friendliness. I think one thing that I would consider in terms of increasing the mental health is having realistic timelines. I think in construction, we tend to be overly optimistic when it comes to our quoting and also the amount of time that we use.
Tadiwa's comments really resonated with Ziad.
It is because our society is built on this kind of let's profit as much as we can type of thing that the clients end up pushing the contractors so hard in terms of timelines. And these timelines end up having cost overruns and budget overruns on the project, as well as it contributes to the lack of safety. So yeah, I kind of agree regarding the lack of realistic standards that we have to set for each other in order to maintain the minimum HSE requirements, whether it's environmental, sustainability, or health. And at the same time, it kind of will reduce the amount of disputes that the contractor and the employer get in. It is imperative that we include the labor in the discussion, because for some reason it's always just engineers talking to engineers, whether it's from the client side or from the contractor side, but usually we don't bring in the actual laborers in the discussion.
And with Hamza as well.
It is so real even in Canada, we're facing the same concern where companies are overcommitting themselves to the projects and ending up with more lawsuits or stress, like Tadiwa mentioned right in her introduction, that there's a lot of stress in this part of the sector. We're facing the same issues here.
Ziad's main concern was how we work together on projects.
I feel like we don't communicate enough, or maybe not per se the lack of communication, but the lack of cooperation. So you may be communicating with each other, and this is from a contractual point of view. I'm the one who sends the variation orders. I'm the one who prepares them. I'm the one who sends letters to the employers and to some of my subcontractors and kind of keeps track of all of these contractual changes. So I feel like This is important. However, at the same time, what's the point of sending all of these letters and claims and stuff if we don't sit on the table and solve the issue at hand at the specific moment? And this is something that I see so many times. They end up throwing the claim up or putting the claim on the side and leaving it at the end of the project where everything is closing out. And then we go like, oh, wait, this person who was in this project who understood this difficulty has now left. So we can't solve it. We don't have the necessary substantiation. So it almost always ends up with management having to deal with it with other management based on amicable standards. I mean, this is cool and all, but it just ends up ignoring the issue until the end of the project. It's sometimes putting the letters on the side and putting the claims on the side and sitting down face to face, whether it's like a 15 minute, like a stand-up meeting, in order to reach kind of a mutual solution on this point today will help the project so much more later on. This is why dispute boards are there. This is why the FEDEC or the International Federation for Construction Contracts, you usually have a dispute board. A dispute board that handles these disputes as they come. And people did data on this and found out that these dispute boards, when they solve the issues at hand during the time, it just helps the project move on.
For Hamza, the big thing was to reform the way we teach the next generation, and he's already doing it. At Durham College, he's been piloting a new approach to the course he teaches on materials, potentially a pretty dry subject.
In the beginning, it was very heavily theory, which is a core requirement for most of these construction management courses. But where I saw the need, and that was through the interviews that we carried out with individual students, just to understand what are they looking for and what are they trying to achieve from this course, was that they were lacking the ability to expose themselves to the actual industry. So what we did was to, every single week, we went to different plants, so concrete plant, cement plants, pavers, steel, wood, lumber factories, and we got them to meet with people that are actually working there and to be given the opportunity to take what they learned in the class and to ask the questions to these people out there in the industry. What are the costs involved? What are the challenges that you're facing? To walk with them and to understand the whole process. And they benefited a lot because now they understood, without reading the books, what actually cement is, what is lumber, what is wood. The second thing that we focused on was, instead of having written assignments, we allowed them to present videos, YouTube videos. They were so more engaged. We're living in an era where ChatGPT has become so common right now that most of the students are just relying on ChatGPT to write their assignments. So by given the opportunity to present, they have the opportunity to actually work on it, understand what they're doing, and be participate in these activities. We also attended many building exhibitions locally in Ontario, Canada, and that helped them massively to see what the technologies are out there. Most of these books that we have and most of the courses are very outdated. They don't really show what's happening in the industry today. And to be present in the industry today, to be given the opportunity to network and meet the industry leaders, that was a massive, massive gain from this course that we developed. It was a small class of only 13 students, but overall, we had more than 92% attendance, which was massive for this course because none of the other courses were anywhere close to this. To have so many students attend the course, be engaged and participate in every single aspect of it. I was able to help develop hunger in these students, and I changed their perspective of what a construction site or construction projects or built environment opportunities are, from making them boring and outdated to making them engaging. Gen Z are looking for ways to make contributions. And now they can see that there are opportunities where they can contribute to this industry and move it forward. And now I'm working on developing a next course, which is on supervision on construction sites. And again, we're going to try and implement as much site exposure and industry exposure that we can provide to these students to make them better leaders and graduates.
Hamza clarified that students are not allowed to use ChatGPT or other AI tools on their assignments, which was a relief to hear. With the conversation coming around to education, the three were eager to share their thoughts on the CIOB.
I think it's made very big leaps in being more inclusive and diverse in its community. We recently have gotten the CIOB Sub-Saharan Africa branch, which has grown and has been absolutely amazing. And I think it's been a wonderful stepping stone for myself, but also having that sense of community as well within that inclusivity and diversity.
Tadiwa also talked about the real difficulties women face in construction and hoped the Institute could offer more support to women around the world.
I think that's something that we're not completely honest about, that this is a very hard industry to be in. So also having those conversations on how do we cope with those kinds of things? How do we make it a better environment for one another? How do we make communication lines more effective? Like Zayed said, it's very important to look at the issue, but okay, this is the issue. How do we fix it? We know this is a problem. How do we go about fixing these issues? And I think the CIOB is a wonderful platform to have those kinds of engagements, have those conversations, and actually not just talk about it, but also as an organization fix those issues.
Ziad expressed the view that CIOB members themselves needed to step up.
The CIOB is very, very important as a leading figure or a professional entity that tries to always upscale the work that we're doing in the construction industry. I also believe that we're very behind in terms of technology or technological advancements for our suppliers or our subcontractors. And even within the contractors, some of them are not technologically advanced and ends up creating a lot of waste. And another aspect is the willingness, I guess, both the professional entity and the people who need to be willing to exchange this information. The CIOB keeps trying to upscale, but the people themselves are unwilling to upscale themselves. So I feel like before we talk about the issues and how to solve them, I think we need to get people to listen, and then we can address these issues and come up with solutions. Because if they're not listening to begin with, then what's the point? Especially employers.
Hamza credited the CIOB for kickstarting his career and agreed with Ziad that the Institute can only be as good as its members.
I got my first two opportunities, career opportunities, through CIOB's Novus events. And I was shocked at the network that I was able to deal with and work with. And it added a lot of value to my career in Malaysia, in Singapore, as well as here in Canada. I really love CIOB's PPE Fits program that's been going around. And it goes well with what Tadiwa mentioned as a joke. But it's a reality that toilets are a huge issue. Even PPE is a big issue. So it shows that different people in the CIOB's network are bringing change, and they're resonating with people from all over the world, including Canada. Where I see CIOB heading in the next 10 or 20 years, I see them bringing more change, more positive change that will help in the career. So I see a lot of frustration in Ziad's words, but it shows that there's still so many opportunities. If I quote one of the past American presidents, it's not what CIOB can do for you, it's what value do you as a member bring to CIOB, and what ideas do you bring to the CIOB network? Recently in Ontario, we had separate toilets for women and for men. Recently, it just shows you how outdated and how behind we are in these small changes, but they are coming. And I'm very sure that CIOB's network will continue to make positive changes through the problems and issues that we're facing.
I found that really inspiring. Huge thanks to Tadiwa, Ziad, and Hamza for sharing their thoughts. Now, Michael Brown knows a thing or two about the professionalization of construction. His dad was a site agent and would take him as a boy on completely unauthorized site visits. In 1966, he was in the first cohort to enroll in the brand new Bachelor of Science degree in building, one of the first in the UK, at Lanchester Polytechnic, now Coventry University, graduating in 1970.
It was quite innovative at the time. And that degree in building, or construction management as it's called now, has become the benchmark for CIOB's academic qualifications for membership of the CIOB. So I really was right at the beginning of that, and it was very interesting to see that progression.
He was treated as an oddity in his work placements.
I came in as a person on a degree course that hadn't existed before. Some people were suspicious, other people, you know, what are you going to do? What do we do with someone who's a degree holder as opposed to someone who's been through a formal apprenticeship? So there was uncertainty there, but I tended to be put on to jobs that were themselves innovation. So the very first industrial training period I had was large concrete panel construction, which came and went very quickly. But unlike other schemes, we had our own factory on site. And, you know, it went through the whole process of making the panels, the units, putting them up into the building and so on. And, of course, it was Rolling Point that this destroyed that as a means of production. I'm not sure that ours was as threatening as Ronan Point, and a lot of work was done to strengthen it and so on, but it just didn't last because of the Ronan Point experience.
He got his first job with a contractor doing big projects in London. His boss, a director of the company, took him to his first meeting of the Institute, then known as the IOB, before it got its Royal Charter in 1980. At work, it's fair to say he was thrown in at the deep end.
They said, we want you to set up a planning department. And I was the planning department. The company hadn't had a planning department or employed a planner before. So the company had no experience of it. But I had been taught something about critical path analysis and Gantt charts and so on when I was studying. You know, going into a job like that from cold, I could see a kind of logic in putting a critical path analysis together, but I had no idea how long the duration should be and so on. And it involved a lot of consultation with people to be able to put a program together. And that was, I suppose, a good experience in itself anyway. And very soon after I started this, one large contract that we had won required the project to be planned using critical path analysis and for it to be run through a computer. There are hundreds of activities. In fact, we did it all on paper. I had a trainee architect helping me on this who was good at drawing. And we did it all on paper. It was a long piece of paper that went around two sides of the room. And we worked the whole thing out by hand. And then knowing that we got the answer right, we put it into a computer, which was nothing to do with us. It was a bureau. Put it into the computer. And of course, it came out right in the end, because we knew it was going to come out right. But that was the level of the technology we were working with. Basically, there was no technology. I was in a situation as a student, whereas being one of the younger persons on the site, I had to go to the top of the tower crane and talk to the operator with messages from below and would he work overtime and so on, because there were no mobile phones. So those sorts of technologies meant that you had to work in very different ways.
In the early 1980s, he worked on major refurbishment projects in London, including for the London Underground and stripping out asbestos from the BBC estate. In the mid-80s, he moved to academia, becoming course leader for the building degree at the Polytechnic of Central London, now the University of Westminster. That brought him into direct contact with the CIOB, because the Institute accredited his course, and he became an examiner for the CIOB qualification. In 1991, he joined the staff as Director of Education. A few years later, he guided the CIOB, which at the time was headquartered in a stately home called Englemere, just outside Ascot, into the internet age.
I had the task to take a proposal to the CIOB board of directors to have one dial-up point to the internet. And it wasn't quite as straightforward as it sounds. But as a result of it, we had one room dedicated to a computer with a dial-up to the internet. And I think the people who went in it were the people who were interested in dial-up. If you didn't see any point to it, you didn't go in the room. But it was mainly used, I think, for emailing at that stage. It's just an example of how in one's career, so much can change.
Looking back, Michael credits the CIOB for numerous pioneering initiatives. It developed the Considerate Constructors Scheme. and led on writing the Code of Practice for Project Management for the Built Environment, now in its sixth edition. But perhaps the most enduring contribution has been education.
There's no doubt that the CIOB has been at the thick of construction management education. And I was delighted at the point of retiring to be given a new fellowship certificate that had Chartered Construction Manager on it. And apparently I was told it was the very first one. But that's something else that has come out of the CIOB. How people in the industry can be recognized for their competence, whether it's charter builder or charter construction manager or other grades of membership. I think there the CIOB has contributed significantly to the industry.
Looking ahead, Michael has some ideas for what the CIOB might do next. One is promoting excellence in design management, because the design function has for years been migrating back into the purview of the building function. Another is something of an elephant in the room: productivity, the industry's chronic struggle to get things built on time and to budget. He's stirred by his experience of China, a country that rebuilt itself in the space of 30 years, and by the work of megaproject scholar Bent Flubier, whose book, How to Get Big Things Done, appeared last year, written with Dan Gardner.
We know in this country that if you've got a deadline that is absolutely fixed, like the Olympic Games, the Millennium Dome, that has to be finished by a certain date and we can do it. But I think an awful lot of projects lack that urgency in terms of delivering on time and to budget for the client. And I think that is something the CIOB should grasp. Right at the core of what we're about as a management institute, begin to do some research in that area. Let's find out what the real situation is, you know. And I think there's a real future for the CIOB here.
Michael extends his birthday wishes to the CIOB and notes how much has changed since 1834 and even in his own lifetime.
This has made me think about the 50-odd years of my career again. That's done me good, I think.
I did enjoy Michael's story about the mysterious room reserved for the computer with a dial-up internet connection. But things have moved on, as BIM Plus editor Justin Stanton is here to tell us. Former government construction advisor Paul Morrell is fond of quoting the Rudyard Kipling poem, A Truthful Song, in which a Victorian housebuilder and a pharaoh converse. The pharaoh says that apart from a bit of the plumbing, he recognises everything that the house builder is doing. How very little, since things were made, things have altered in the building trade. In light of that, ask yourself, how much has construction management really evolved during your career? And if it hasn't, isn't it time that it should? And surely such an evolution should be based on data and information. In a Global Construction Summit webinar staged in February, representatives from Bill Dotts, Lang O'Rourke and Waite's group debated the possible next step for construction management, what Bill Dotts calls performance-driven construction management. Let's get the basics from Paul Bamforth, Head of Global Strategic Accounts at Bill Dotts.
And what Bill Dotts is about is capturing the reality of the site through the use of a GoPro camera, really a video saying what is the state of the project today. And then with also a 4D representation of a project in terms of a combination of the design, the BIM model, and the associated plan, whether that be Power Project, whether it be P6 from Oracle, whatever it might be, the two things together allow us to start doing some analysis. So that analysis has really started with, in those early days, the fit-out matrix. A fit-out matrix you could trust for that meeting on a Monday morning between you and the supply chain. But it was very quickly clear that that's just the start. That's some data that can be of some value. But really making sure we can help, one, our partners, but also the industry as a whole, we undertook a study across 64 projects that we utilized in BuildOps, but more importantly, the data that was associated with it. We started to see, because those projects range from classic residential builds, office builds, to also industrial projects, is there a sort of a relationship between the data that we have and the inefficiencies that the projects are experiencing? And it's very quickly clear that data can be turned into information, can be turned into control. So that was a starting point. because it's really about making a shift from reactive, the classic way, which has been historically perhaps the only way of reacting to projects that sort of fallen behind the schedule. But can we actually be a little bit more proactive in the earlier parts of the project, start to measure performance using the progress data to sort of have actionable insights, be a bit more proactive in terms of the management, identify the delays early on, because what might be a problem today could be an even bigger problem tomorrow. Let's measure regularly. Let's measure and use the information that we might have from progress information and start identifying and analyze what the consequences are or what the issues are should be for us for having those delays. It might be a pace of work, might be a lack of resource. So let's analyze that, then optimize. Do we need to put more people on? Do we need to look at the sequences that we have of the work that we've got in place to maximize the utilization of the site and also make sure we use the spaces available to improve that performance and delivery of the project? So in summary, it's about being proactive. It's using the information that we have today to help people control the destiny of the project.
Andy Steele, strategic advisor and former chief executive of Osborne, illustrated the difference between traditional construction management and performance-driven construction management, and the difference between a lagging indicator and a leading indicator.
You know, the human eye is incapable of determining whether something's 47% complete or 51% complete. We can't do it. I'm a surveyor. I can't do it. 47% complete, that trade is 2.5 weeks behind, that lagging indicator. Leading indicator, it's 6 months behind at that production rate.
As an example of performance-driven construction management, Steele highlighted the issue of trades returning to site.
So what is causing that return visit? Is it a design issue? Is it a performance issue? Understanding those returns, understanding why we're going back in to make good certain areas, and actually then looking at those, learning from those. And we have seen, and we see regularly, that, you know, we can design out some of that return visit. You know, simple example, duct work, rather than having to manufacture the last section, which is an on-site measure, put on, you know, designing a flexible, you know, flexible final fitting. Costs more, but speeds up production. So think in the same way is my request for the designers. Think about performance.
Paul Drayton is head of Digital Europe at Lang O'Rourke. He drew on his experience outside of construction to illustrate the difference in mindset.
An observation that I've seen within construction, but also within the other, you know, defence, aerospace, nuclear sectors that I've had the privilege of working in. So often we focus on the lagging measures, which report performance, they report output. The challenge is, if our performance has fallen short, we've missed the opportunity to do anything about it. You know, the horse is bolted. And then because we haven't got the metrics that underpin that, we start dealing with opinions, and I think this is the biggest problem, and it's them over there that's causing me my project delays. So we start reacting to opinions rather than dealing with facts and data and evidence to make those informed decisions. But by the time we start to see performance being impacted, it's probably the last link in a chain of a whole sequence of complicated activities. And by the time something manifests itself with our workforce, it was probably born weeks, maybe even months upstream, where, I don't know, a design error was introduced or a material wasn't ordered on time. So it's important to measure the output performance to understand how you're getting on. But actually, I think we need to understand what are the key drivers of lost performance, and we need to actively manage those. That's where the kind of the leading measure bit comes in for me.
Gareth Handley, Director of Operations at Waits Group, outlined what Waits and he want from information.
Ultimately, what we're looking for, and what I'm principally focused upon, is really a single source of truth. You know, having something that allows us to really measure our projects and understand exactly what's happening on our projects. Yeah, Andy said at the start as well, we want to be able to see where projects are going. We want to be able to see that at a very global scale and have really clear and defined information. But also that we want to be able to allow our teams to be able to use that information. So ultimately what we're looking for is information that allows us to save time, particularly with the way that we plan our works and record where we are on our projects, because it can be very time consuming, particularly on larger projects, but also clear, concise information. Information that can be used at a high level to understand where the project is and where it's going, more importantly, and see those trends. And ultimately, being able to influence it at ground level, but also being able to influence at a higher level where we can make those big calls.
And Handley offered this plea to any technology providers in the built environment.
This is a big one for me. Please don't make anything complicated ever.
You can register to catch up on that webinar and learn more about performance-driven construction management. Search Summit on the Global Construction Review website.
Thank you, Justin. That's all we have time for this month. We hope you found it interesting. If you like the podcast, tell others by rating it wherever you found it. Give us a mention on social media with the hashtag 21ccpodcast. You can email us on 21cc@atompublishing.co.uk. Thanks for listening.